A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about overfitting, what it actually is, when and why it happens, and how to avoid it. And I think what makes this worth digging into is that overfitting isn't just some academic footnote in machine learning. It's the fundamental tension in basically every predictive model anyone builds, from the simplest regression to the largest language model. Get it wrong, and your model is useless in the real world.
Most people think they understand overfitting, but the moment you push past the textbook definition, things get genuinely subtle. Also, quick note, today's episode script is coming from DeepSeek V4 Pro, so if anything sounds unusually coherent, that's why.
I was going to say, if I sound smarter than usual, there's an explanation. But yes, overfitting. Let's actually define it properly. Because I hear people throw the term around as a catch-all for model bad, and that's not what it means.
The classic definition, and I'm pulling this straight from the way Hasty and Tipshirani lay it out in Elements of Statistical Learning. Overfitting happens when a model learns the noise in your training data instead of the underlying signal. You get a model that performs beautifully on the data it was trained on and then falls apart on anything new. The gap between training performance and test performance is the tell.
The noise versus signal. Framing is doing a lot of work there. Because what counts as noise versus signal depends entirely on what you're trying to model. If you're predicting housing prices and your model is latched onto the fact that one specific house on Elm Street sold for way above market because the buyer was in a bidding war, that's noise. That pattern won't generalize. But your model doesn't know that. It just sees a data point.
And this connects to something I think gets lost in a lot of the popular explanations. Overfitting isn't a binary condition. It's not like your model is either overfit or it isn't. It's a spectrum. Every model is overfit to some degree. The question is whether the degree of overfitting is problematic for what you're trying to do.
Walk me through when overfitting actually happens. What are the conditions that make it more likely?
The classic setup is when you have a model that's too complex relative to the amount of data you have. Think about fitting a polynomial to a scatter plot. If you have 10 data points and you fit a ninth degree polynomial, you can make that curve wiggle through every single point perfectly. Zero training error. But the curve between those points is going to be completely insane. And if you add one new data point, it'll probably land nowhere near your wiggly curve.
The polynomial example is useful because it makes the complexity thing visual and intuitive. But the same dynamic plays out in ways that are much harder to visualize when you're dealing with high-dimensional data.
That's exactly where it gets dangerous, because with one or two input variables, you can plot your model's decision boundary and see that it's doing something weird. You can visually spot overfitting. With 1,000 features, you can't plot anything meaningful. You're flying blind, relying entirely on your evaluation metrics to tell you whether you've crossed the line.
Complexity relative to data is one trigger. What about the data itself? Does noisy data make overfitting worse?
Noisy data is basically overfitting fuel. If your training data has a lot of irreducible error, measurement error, labeling mistakes, stochastic phenomena, and you give your model enough capacity, it will absolutely memorize those errors. It doesn't know they're errors, they're just patterns in the data.
There's a grim irony there. The more careful you are about collecting real-world data, the messier it tends to be. Clean lab data is easier to model. Messy real-world data is where overfitting bites hardest.
It's where you most need the model to work well. That's the cruel part. I saw a paper from Google Brain a few years back looking at this in medical imaging. They found that models trained on cleaner datasets from academic hospitals often failed when deployed at community hospitals because the community hospital data had different noise characteristics. The models had overfit to the specific noise profile of the clean academic data.
That's a concrete example worth sitting with. So the model wasn't just overfitting to random noise, it was overfitting to systematic noise, the quirks of a specific data collection pipeline.
and that's a much harder problem to catch because your validation data often comes from the same pipeline. So your validation metrics look fine, and you think you're good, and then you deploy and everything breaks.
Let's talk about the bias variance trade-off here, because that's the theoretical framework that makes sense of all this. And I know it's been covered elsewhere, but I think a lot of people get the relationship between bias, variance, and overfitting slightly wrong.
Let's do it. So the bias variance decomposition is one of those ideas that, once you really internalize it, changes how you think about every model you build. The core insight is that prediction error can be broken down into three components. You've got irreducible error, which is just the inherent noise in the problem. Then you've got bias, which is error from the model being too simple to capture the true underlying pattern. And then you've got variance, which is error from the model being so sensitive that small changes in the training data produce wildly different predictions.
Overfitting lives entirely on the variance side of that trade-off.
A high variance model is one that's overfitting. It's capturing not just the signal, but the specific random quirks of this particular training set. If you trained it on a slightly different sample from the same distribution, you'd get a noticeably different model. That's the hallmark of overfitting, sensitivity to the specific training sample.
What I think people get wrong is they assume low bias is always good. Like, my model has low bias, it's capturing all the nuances. But low bias is exactly what you get with overfitting. The model has so much capacity that it can represent almost anything, including the noise. High bias is underfitting. Low bias plus high variance is overfitting.
This is where the trade-off framing comes in. For decades, the standard wisdom was that you have to navigate this trade-off. Reduce bias, variance goes up. Reduce variance, bias goes up. You're looking for the sweet spot. But here's something that's changed in the last several years, and I think this is where a lot of textbook explanations are now outdated. The deep learning era has complicated the bias-variance story significantly.
Say more about that. Because I remember the classic U-shaped test error curve from every machine learning course. Too simple, underfit. Too complex, overfit. But you're saying that picture doesn't hold in the same way for deep neural networks.
There's this phenomenon called double descent that's been getting a lot of attention since around 2019, when a group at MIT and Harvard published a paper that basically showed the classical bias variance curve isn't the whole story. What they found is that as you keep increasing model complexity past the point of interpolation, past the point where you have enough parameters to perfectly fit the training data, test error starts going down again.
That's counterintuitive. The model has way more parameters than training examples. It can memorize everything, and yet it generalizes better?
It is completely counterintuitive. And it's one of the reasons large language models work at all. By the classical bias variance framework, models with hundreds of billions of parameters trained on datasets that are smaller than their parameter count should be overfitting catastrophically. And yet, they generalize. Not perfectly, but far better than the old theory would predict.
What's actually happening there? What's the mechanism?
I'm going to be honest. This is an area where I'm not fully confident in my understanding, and the field is still working out the theory. But the broad idea seems to be that when you have massive overparameterization, the optimization process itself has an implicit regularization effect. Gradient descent, especially with stochastic gradient descent, tends to find solutions that are somehow simpler or have better generalization properties, even though the model has the capacity to memorize everything.
The optimization algorithm is doing some of the work that we use to explicitly handle with regularization techniques.
That's the emerging picture. It doesn't mean overfitting isn't a problem for deep learning. It absolutely is. But the relationship between model size, data size, and generalization is more complex than the simple too many parameters equals overfitting story.
All right, let's get practical then. Daniel asked how to avoid overfitting, and I think we should cover the toolkit, from the classics to the more modern approaches. What's the first line of defense?
The absolute foundation is proper train test splitting. And I don't just mean splitting your data. I mean being scrupulously honest about it. Your test set is sacred. You do not look at it during model development. You do not use it to make decisions. You touch it exactly once at the very end to get your final estimate of generalization performance.
People cheat on this constantly without realizing they're cheating. They'll look at test performance, tweak something, look again, tweak something else. And each time they do that, the test set becomes a little bit more like a validation set. The information leaks.
This is exactly why you need a three-way split. Training set for fitting parameters, validation set for tuning hyperparameters and making model selection decisions, and a held-out test set for the final evaluation. The validation set will get overfit to some degree. That's just what happens when you use it to make decisions. But the test set stays clean.
Then there's cross-validation, which is basically a more sophisticated version of this. You rotate which chunk of data serves as the validation set, train on the rest, and average the results.
K-fold cross-validation is the workhorse here. You split your training data into, say, 5 or 10 folds. For each fold, you train on the other folds and validate on this one. You get multiple estimates of performance, which gives you not just a point estimate, but a sense of the variance. If your performance varies wildly across folds, that's a red flag for instability, which often means overfitting.
What about when cross-validation itself can mislead you?
Cross-validation can fail when your data has structure that the random splitting doesn't respect. The classic case is time series data. If you randomly shuffle time series data into folds, you're training on future data and testing on past data. That's information leakage. Your cross-validation scores will look amazing and be completely meaningless.
Because in the real world, you never get to train on the future and predict the past.
For time series, you need to do something like forward chaining, where you always train on earlier periods and test on later periods. It's more computationally expensive, and you get fewer splits, but it actually simulates the deployment condition.
All right, so proper evaluation setup is the foundation, but that tells you whether you're overfitting. It doesn't prevent it. What are the actual techniques for reducing overfitting?
Let me start with the one that I think is underappreciated and how effective it is relative to how simple it is. Get more data. If overfitting happens because your model is too complex for the amount of data you have, the most direct solution is to increase the denominator. More data means the model has less opportunity to memorize individual noise patterns.
In practice, get more data can mean a lot of different things. It might mean collecting new data. It might mean data augmentation, creating synthetic variations of your existing data that preserve the signal while varying the noise.
Data augmentation is huge, especially in computer vision. You take an image of a cat, you rotate it slightly, you crop it differently, you adjust the brightness, and suddenly you have 5 training examples instead of 1. The model learns that cat is invariant to these transformations. It can't overfit to the specific pixel arrangement of the original image because it's seen variations.
There's an art to knowing which augmentations preserve the signal. If you're classifying animals, flipping an image horizontally is fine. A flipped cat is still a cat. If you're classifying letters, flipping a B horizontally gives you a D. And now you've corrupted your labels.
Domain knowledge matters enormously for augmentation. You need to know which variations are label preserving and which aren't.
Beyond data, what about constraining the model itself? That's where regularization comes in.
Regularization, broadly, is anything you do to constrain model complexity. The classic technique is L2 regularization, also called weight decay or ridge regression depending on context. You add a penalty to the loss function that's proportional to the squared magnitude of the model parameters. This pushes all parameters towards 0, which prevents any single parameter from becoming too large and dominating the predictions.
The intuition there is that large parameter values tend to correspond to wiggly, high-variance models. By keeping the parameters small, you're smoothing things out.
That's the geometric intuition, yes. L1 regularization, or lasso, takes a different approach. It penalizes the absolute values of parameters rather than their squares. This has the effect of driving some parameters exactly to 0, which performs feature selection. The model becomes sparser.
Oh. 2 shrinks everything. L1 kills things entirely.
That's the one sentence summary, yes. And then there's ElasticNet, which combines both penalties. You get the feature selection of L1 with the stability of L2.
What about the regularization techniques that are more specific to neural networks?
Dropout is the big one. And I still think dropout is one of the most elegant ideas in machine learning. During training, you randomly drop out a fraction of the neurons in each layer on each forward pass. Each neuron has some probability of being temporarily removed. This forces the network to learn redundant representations. No single neuron can become indispensable because it might not be there on any given training step.
You're effectively training an ensemble of exponentially many subnetworks, and at test time, you use the full network with scaled weights.
And what's beautiful about it is that it's computationally almost free. You're just randomly zeroing out activations during training, but the regularization effect is substantial. It was introduced by Hinton's group in 2012, and then really took off after the AlexNet paper that won ImageNet that year used it extensively.
I want to talk about early stopping, because that's another one that's deceptively simple, but has deep connections to regularization theory.
Early stopping might be the most intuitive regularization technique. You monitor validation performance during training, and when validation error stops improving and starts getting worse, you stop. That inflection point is where overfitting begins. Before that, both training and validation error are decreasing. After that, training error keeps going down, but validation error rises. You're now fitting noise.
There's been interesting theoretical work showing that early stopping is approximately equivalent to L2 regularization. The number of training steps acts as an inverse regularization parameter. Fewer steps means more regularization.
That connection is not obvious at first glance, but it makes sense when you think about it. When you train for fewer steps, the parameters don't have time to grow large and specialized. You're effectively keeping them close to their initialization, which is similar to what weight decay does.
Let's talk about ensemble methods. Bagging, boosting. These are also overfitting countermeasures, right?
Yes, though in different ways. Bagging, which is short for bootstrap aggregating, directly attacks variance. You train multiple models on different bootstrap samples of the training data and average their predictions. Because each model sees a slightly different data set, their overfitting patterns are uncorrelated. Averaging cancels out the noise. Random forests are the canonical example.
Boosting is a different beast entirely.
Boosting is interesting because it can actually overfit if you're not careful, especially with noisy data. The idea is you train models sequentially, each one focusing on the examples the previous models got wrong. This reduces bias aggressively, but if you keep going too long, you'll eventually start fitting noise. Gradient boosting libraries like XGBoost and LightGBM have early stopping built in for exactly this reason.
Bagging reduces variance. Boosting reduces bias, but can increase variance if you overdo it. Different tools for different parts of the problem.
Korn, I want to pull on a thread you mentioned earlier about implicit regularization in deep learning. Because I think there's something important here about how the optimization process itself can prevent overfitting even without explicit regularization techniques. This is one of the most active areas of theoretical machine learning research. The observation is that stochastic gradient descent with small batch sizes seems to have a built-in preference for simpler solutions. The noise in the gradient estimates acts as a kind of regularizer. It prevents the optimization from settling into sharp minima. Solutions where the loss function has high curvature, and instead steers it toward flat minima.
Flat minima generalize better. That's the connection.
The intuition is that a flat minimum is robust to small perturbations. If you wiggle the parameters a little, the loss doesn't change much. That means the solution is likely to work well on slightly different data. A sharp minimum, which you might find if you use full-batch gradient descent and no regularization, can have excellent training loss but terrible generalization, because a tiny shift in the parameters leads to a huge increase in loss.
The stochasticity isn't a bug. It's doing useful work.
It's a feature, not a bug, and this connects to why large batch sizes can sometimes hurt generalization. If you use very large batches, the gradient estimates become very precise, and the optimization can find sharper minima. There's been work at Facebook AI Research and elsewhere showing that you sometimes need to adjust your learning rate and regularization when you scale up batch size or generalization suffers.
Let's talk about overfitting in the context Daniel probably encounters most, language models, because the dynamics there are quite specific.
For large language models, the overfitting picture is different from classical machine learning. These models are so massively overparameterized that, by the textbook definition, they should be the most overfit models in history. GPT-4 has somewhere north of a trillion parameters, trained on trillions of tokens, but they generalize remarkably well to prompts they've never seen.
They do memorize. We've seen studies showing that language models can regurgitate training data verbatim under certain conditions.
They absolutely memorize. The interesting question is what they memorize and why. There was a paper from a group including researchers at Google DeepMind and several universities that came out in 2023 looking at this systematically. They found that memorization is heavily concentrated in duplicated training data. If a sequence appears many times in the training corpus, the model is much more likely to memorize it. Unique or rare sequences are far less likely to be memorized.
Which makes intuitive sense. The model is seeing that duplicated text as a strong signal. From the model's perspective, it's a robust pattern worth learning precisely.
This is where the line between overfitting and useful memorization gets blurry. If you're building a model that needs to quote exact legal statutes or recall specific historical facts, some degree of memorization is a feature, not a bug. The problem is, when the model memorizes in ways that leak private information or reproduce copyrighted content.
How do people address overfitting in language models specifically?
A few approaches. One is deduplication of training data. If you remove near-duplicate documents, you reduce the incentive for the model to memorize. This has become standard practice. Another is training on more data for fewer epochs. The current paradigm is to train on massive datasets for roughly one epoch, sometimes less. The model sees each example once or maybe a few times, which naturally limits memorization.
As opposed to the old image classification paradigm, where you train for hundreds of epochs on the same dataset.
When you train for one epoch on a dataset of trillions of tokens, the model barely has time to overfit to any particular example. It's learning broad statistical patterns because that's all it can do in a single pass.
There's also the architectural side. Things like attention dropout, residual dropout, layer normalization. These all have regularizing effects.
Weight tying, which is used in many transformer models. You tie the input embedding weights to the output projection weights, which dramatically reduces the number of parameters and acts as a strong regularizer. It forces the model to use the same representation for understanding and generation.
I want to come back to something practical. Daniel asked how to avoid overfitting, and I think the honest answer is that you can't avoid it entirely. You manage it. You keep it at an acceptable level. What does that actually look like in a real workflow?
It starts with knowing what acceptable means for your specific problem. If you're building a recommendation system for an e-commerce site, some overfitting is fine. You're not making life or death decisions. If your model is slightly overfit to your user base, it'll still recommend products people like. The cost of being wrong is low.
Versus medical diagnosis, where overfitting can have catastrophic consequences.
In high-stakes domains, you need to be much more conservative. You might accept higher bias, a simpler model that's systematically slightly off but never wildly wrong, in exchange for lower variance. You'd rather have a model that's consistently mediocre than one that's occasionally brilliant and occasionally disastrous.
That's a framing I don't hear enough. Overfitting isn't just a technical problem. It's a risk management problem. How much variance can you tolerate given the cost of errors?
That's a business decision, not a machine learning decision. The data scientist's job is to quantify the trade-off. The stakeholder's job is to decide where on that curve they want to operate.
What are the signals that tell you, in practice, that you're overfitting, beyond just looking at the drain test gap?
One thing I always look at is the distribution of prediction errors. If your model is overfit, you'll often see that most predictions are very confident and very wrong on the test set. The model has learned to be extremely certain about patterns that don't generalize. High confidence with low accuracy is a classic overfitting signature.
Calibration plots can surface this. If you bin your predictions by confidence level and plot actual accuracy against predicted confidence, an overfit model will show a big gap. It thinks it's 95% confident, but is actually right 70% of the time.
Calibration is such an underused diagnostic. Everyone looks at aggregate metrics like accuracy or F1 score. But those can hide all kinds of overfitting problems. A well-calibrated model that's slightly less accurate is often more useful than a miscalibrated model with higher accuracy.
Because you can act on the probabilities. If the model says 60% chance of rain, and it actually rains 60% of the time when it says that, you can make decisions. If it says 90% chance of rain, and it rains 50% of the time, the number is meaningless.
And this connects to something I think is under-discussed. Overfitting isn't just about point predictions being wrong, it's about the entire probability distribution being wrong. An overfit model doesn't just miss the target. It's confidently wrong in ways that are hard to detect without careful evaluation.
Let's touch on a few more specific techniques before we wrap up the core discussion. Feature selection. That's a classic approach to reducing overfitting.
Feature selection is one of those things that sounds boring, but is incredibly important in practice. The more features you have, the more opportunities your model has to find spurious correlations. If you have 1,000 features and 100 training examples, your model will absolutely find some feature that perfectly separates your classes by pure chance. That's not a real pattern. That's overfitting to noise in a high-dimensional space.
There's a whole taxonomy of feature selection approaches. Filter methods that rank features by statistical properties independent of the model. Wrapper methods that use the model itself to evaluate feature subsets. Embedded methods like L1 regularization that do feature selection as part of training.
The scikit-learn documentation has a great example of this. They show how a simple linear regression with polynomial features can go from underfitting to good fit to severe overfitting just by increasing the polynomial degree. At degree 1, it's a straight line that doesn't capture the curve. At degree 4, it fits beautifully. At degree 15, it's a wiggly mess that hits every training point but is useless for interpolation.
That's the visualization that should be in everyone's head when they think about overfitting. The degree 15 polynomial that weaves through every point but tells you nothing about the underlying relationship.
The thing is, the degree 15 polynomial has lower training error than the degree 4 polynomial. If you only looked at training error, you'd pick the worst model every time.
Which brings us back to the fundamental point. You cannot evaluate a model on the data it was trained on. That's not evaluation. That's just measuring how good the model's memory is.
Yet people do this constantly. They report training accuracy. They're impressed by how well their model fits the training data. And then they're confused when it doesn't work in production.
Let's talk about one more technique. Pruning. Specifically for tree-based models and neural networks.
Pruning is the idea that you train a complex model and then systematically remove parts of it that don't contribute much. For decision trees, you grow a full tree and then prune back branches that don't improve validation performance. For neural networks, you can prune individual weights or entire neurons based on their magnitude or contribution to the output.
The advantage over just training a smaller model from scratch?
There's evidence that pruning can find better solutions than training a small model directly. The large model explores a broader space during training, and then pruning selects a compact subnetwork that retains the important learned patterns. It's like writing a long draft and then editing it down versus trying to write a tight final version on the first attempt.
That's the lottery ticket hypothesis, right? The idea that within a large, randomly initialized network, there exists a small subnetwork that can be trained in isolation to achieve comparable performance.
The lottery ticket hypothesis from Jonathan Frankel and Michael Carbon at M in 2018. It's a fascinating idea that's generated a lot of follow-up work. The implication is that overparameterization during training helps with optimization, even if the final model doesn't need all those parameters.
I think we've covered the conceptual and practical ground pretty thoroughly. Let me try to synthesize what we've said into something actionable.
Go for it.
Overfitting is when your model learns noise instead of signal. It happens when model complexity outstrips the information content of your data. You detect it by watching the gap between training and validation performance. You prevent it through a layered defense. Proper data splitting, cross-validation, regularization techniques, careful feature selection, and sometimes just getting more data. And in the modern deep learning context, some of the classical intuitions need updating. Bigger models don't always overfit more. The optimization process itself can provide implicit regularization.
That's a solid summary. The only thing I'd add is that overfitting is ultimately an empirical question. You can't reason about it purely from first principles. You have to measure it. You have to look at your validation curves, your calibration plots, your error distributions. The theory tells you where to look. The data tells you what's actually happening.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The average cumulus cloud weighs approximately 1.1 million pounds, roughly the same as 100 elephants floating above your head.
If Daniel is asking about overfitting, what should he actually do differently tomorrow?
First thing, look at your current projects and check whether you have a proper held-out test set that you've never peeked at. If you don't, create one now. If you do, honestly assess how many times you've looked at it. If the answer is more than zero before your final evaluation, you need a fresh test set.
Second, plot your learning curves, training error and validation error as a function of model complexity or training time. If those curves are diverging, you've got an overfitting problem. If they're both still decreasing, you can probably push further.
Third, consider whether you're using the right regularization for your problem. If you're doing classical machine learning with tabular data, L1 or L2 regularization should be on by default. If you're doing deep learning, dropout and early stopping are your friends. If you're doing gradient boosting, watch your tree depth and learning rate.
Fourth, and this is the one people skip because it's not glamorous, do a proper error analysis. Don't just look at aggregate metrics. Look at where your model is confident and wrong. Those are the cases where overfitting is biting you. Understanding the pattern of errors will tell you what kind of overfitting you're dealing with.
Finally, if you're working with language models or other large-scale systems, think about data deduplication. The research is clear that duplicated training data is a major driver of memorization. Tools exist to do this.
One thing we haven't said explicitly, overfitting is not always the enemy. There are cases where you want your model to essentially memorize. If you're building a lookup system, or if your training data perfectly represents your deployment distribution and nothing will ever change, overfitting is fine. It's just that those conditions almost never hold in the real world.
That's an important caveat. The goal isn't to eliminate overfitting, it's to calibrate it to the needs of your application. A model that generalizes perfectly is a theoretical ideal. In practice, you're managing a trade-off.
Here's a question I'm left with. As models get larger and datasets get larger, are we converging on architectures and training procedures that are naturally robust to overfitting? Or are we just pushing the overfitting problem into more subtle forms that are harder to detect?
I think it's both. The double descent phenomenon and the success of large language models suggest that scale itself provides some regularization, but we're also seeing new failure modes, models that are subtly miscalibrated. Models that perform well on benchmarks but fail on distribution shifts that are too small for standard evaluation to catch. Overfitting isn't going away, it's just getting more sophisticated.
That means the people building these systems need to get more sophisticated about detecting it.
The fundamentals still matter. Proper evaluation hygiene, understanding your data, thinking carefully about what signal and noise mean in your specific context. No amount of scale eliminates the need for that.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumentop for producing, as always. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts.
If you found this useful, leave us a review wherever you listen.
We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.